Year Zero, a radical reimagining of society where all past traditions, institutions, and cultures are eradicated to create a new world order. Most famously attempted in Cambodia by the Khmer Rouge, the band of communists who somehow took control of the country and proceeded to exterminate half the population. Their vision? To transform Cambodia into a classless, agrarian utopia. The execution was brutal. Cities were emptied, intellectuals liquidated, and the country plunged into a nightmare of forced labor, starvation, and mass executions. An estimated 2 million people perished in the pursuit of their workers' paradise. But Cambodia was not alone in this drastic attempt at social engineering. Earlier, Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution in China had aimed to obliterate the four olds, old customs, culture, habits, and ideas. In 1966, Mao mobilized the youth into the Red Guards to attack intellectuals, destroy cultural relics, and purge counter-revolutionaries. The decade-long upheaval left millions dead and scarred the nation's cultural heritage forever. In the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin's regime undertook its own form of societal re-engineering. Through a series of five-year plans, Stalin aimed to rapidly industrialize the Soviet economy, collectivize agriculture, and eliminate perceived enemies of the state. Millions were executed or sent to gulags to be worked to death. The traditional life of the peasant was shattered in pursuit of supposed progress and by the subsequent famine that killed yet further millions. In North Korea, Kim Il-sung built a totalitarian state on his Juche ideology. All aspects of life were controlled by this state, its founding principles, self-reliance, and loyalty to the leader. History was rewritten, citizens indoctrinated before they learned to read, and all information rigidly controlled by the North Korean government. Generations have grown up knowing only the narrative crafted by the Kim dynasty, cut off from the outside world.
The 2nd of May 1997 is Year Zero. It is the date that Tony Blair and New Labour came to power after 17 years in opposition, with the aim of fundamentally changing the entire nature of the country, remoulding it in line with their ideology, such that what they had done could never be undone, such that a fundamental break was made with the past. They did this in so many ways. They changed the laws so that freedom of expression was heavily restricted. Suddenly, crimes could be racially motivated and you would receive a worse sentence if it was perceived to be racially motivated. This had never happened before in English history. Suddenly, they politicized the police service and forced the police, using the Stephen Lawrence murder as their excuse, to be infiltrated with left-wing ideas. Policemen stood up and said that they treated black people and white people exactly the same, and they were told this was wrong, this was immoral. How dare they? They should take into account the differences these people have experienced in growing up. Suddenly, being equal before the law was out, was no longer the case. Speech became heavily regulated, such that we saw the beginnings of cancel culture, such that Wendy Richard, who played Pauline in EastEnders, used the word Oriental and was condemned for doing so and couldn't believe the reaction she received.
It's pushable Chinese and she's Thai, but it's all Oriental, isn't it? And she, well, it is to me anyway.
And then later it was okay to use the word Oriental. People started to regulate speech like something, and of course it's a cliche, but like something out of 1984, where the party used speech as a way of controlling you. They also used speech as a way of breaking the connection with the past. Up until that point, English people had a feeling, a connection with their ancestors, a connection with the Anglo-Saxons, a connection with the final great invasion of this country, the invasion by us, the English people. They perceived themselves to be a race. They perceived themselves to be an ethnic group, part of one large genetic family. Suddenly, all of this changed. language had to be regulated, and it was regulated as a way of cutting a break with the past. An example is the word coloured. This was a perfectly acceptable way to describe people. Then this had to change to ethnic minority, and then to minority ethnic, and then people of colour, despite there being no semantic difference between these terms. This had two purposes. One was as a way of forcing you to submit to power, forcing you via your speech to display or not your loyalty to the regime and to display or not your intellectual abilities, but also as a way of making a break with the past. Suddenly, everything from the past was offensive and unacceptable and insensitive, a way of drawing a fundamental line between the past and now. The 2nd of May, therefore, became a kind of year zero of the fore and after. The fore was the bad, insensitive, racist, sexist, homophobic, conservative world where everybody was equal before the law, where there was essentially free speech, where you couldn't be cancelled for stating your opinion, where you could walk up to someone on a park bench and say, "Can I sit there?" And they'd say, "Oh, free country." And then there was the world after it, where nobody would say this anymore. The year zero, where we constantly have to say, "I shouldn't be saying this," but where we constantly have to be concerned that we might offend people, where we are constantly policed and called out for the bad things we've said, which are ultimately dissenting from the new ideology that we are all equal and that the worst thing possible is to hurt someone's feelings. This was the ideology of New Labour. This was year zero.
Year zero is more than a date. It is the totalitarian desire to remake society from the ground up. Whether through the brutality of the Khmer Rouge, Mao's Cultural Revolution, Stalin's purges, or North Korea's isolation, the quest for an idealized society inevitably leads to immense human suffering and untold cultural destruction. Britain, 1997. The country has somehow become cool again, with a vibrant, energetic, world-spanning pop culture. And yet the leadership of the nation couldn't be more drab. The old ideologies of socialism and conservatism seemed outdated, relics of a bygone age, as distant and irrelevant as the Cold War. Blair, with his charm, sincerity, and youth, embodied a new kind of politics, one that transcended traditional boundaries of left and right. The Third Way. As had been the case in the USA 5 years earlier, in 1997, the balance of power by which Britain was governed shifted. The children of the baby boom, forged in the crucible of 1960s radicalism, had never struggled and fought as their parents had. They'd never been troubled by national service and had enjoyed every benefit of a generous and industrious state. Finally, they had taken power. The age of men was over. The age of the boomer had come. On the surface, New Labour appeared a slick, modernising force devoted to rebranding Britain for a globalised age. But beneath the soundbites and spin lay a radical heart, still beating to the rhythms of the 1960s countercultural uprisings. Peter Mandelson, a key figure in Tony Blair's cabinet, was a member of the Young Communist League. Jack Straw, who would hold two of the great offices of state, was president of the National Union of Students from 1969-1971 at its most radical. Charles Clark, who became Education Secretary, was president of the National Union of Students from 1975-1977 and at the forefront of student activism. Patricia Hewitt was a communist sympathiser. Nearly every New Labour minister had an extreme left past, which they cravenly concealed from the public. Clark's successor as Home Secretary, John Reid, was notably influenced by the ideas of the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci and would pepper his speeches with his quotes. Gramsci's theory of cultural hegemony posits that state power is maintained not just through coercion, but also through ideological control of society and of its culture. Reid, the enforcer of New Labour, used a strategic focus to ensure public opinion and every element of the state fell into line with New Labour's ideological framework. He famously attacked the intelligence services in public when they questioned the clear and obvious deception Labour used to force Britain into the war with Iraq. It was from these minds that the New Labour project came. Rather than a short burst of socialism that could be undone by another Tory government, the plan was to take hold of the levers of power and never let them go. The civil service, the BBC, the institutions would all be New Labour in mind and spirit. Even the Conservative Party itself, the natural party of government, would have its principles dictated to it by New Labour.
The Daily Telegraph columnist Boris Johnson stood unsuccessfully for the Tories in the last election. He supports William Hague's efforts this week to convince people that the Tories aren't out of touch. We asked him to try out the podium and give his version of what William Hague should say.
So I say, let's get ourselves a fresh future, a fresh future. Let's chuck away the tired, stale old future and let's have a fresh start, a fresh upstart. And I tell you this, unless we change, unless we become a little bit hip, a tiny bit cool, unless we learn to marry our free market policies, our self-reliance and broad Euro-scepticism with a little bit of Blairite touchy-feeliness, we aren't history, ladies and gentlemen. We are geology.
Values like social justice and workers' rights were rebranded as the stakeholder society. The upheaval they sought was marketed as modernization, giving the impression of an inevitable technological progression. New Labour embraced the information age as a vector for its radical ideas, harnessing computers and databases to map out a total reshaping of the state and of public services. In 1996, David Willetts, a Conservative MP, produced a pamphlet known as Blair's Gurus in an attempt to establish the origins of Blair's worldview. Willetts singled out the philosopher John Gray as the originator of Blair's ceaseless rhetoric about communities. Gray was attempting to dismantle the liberal economic ideas of the Thatcher years, where human beings were little more than engines of market forces and economic self-interest. Rather, we were shaped by and bound to the communities in which we lived. In 1994, Blair wrote that Labour's vision is of a Britain that is not just a collection of individuals, but a society where a decent community backs up the efforts of the individuals within it. That change can't come through market forces. It needs active government, local and national. The message was clear. You cannot be trusted to behave by yourself and choose your own path in life. You must be guided by the benevolent hand of the state, from cradle to grave. The dream of overthrowing the established order had been deferred, not abandoned. As students, they had marched on the barricades, demanding a complete restructuring of society along socialist lines. Now, they plotted their revolution by evolution, adapting the old language of resistance to a new focus group age.
The Mother of Parliament's there, once the final word, the place in which the law of the land was decided, until Tony Blair came to power. And Tony Blair's sole aim was to tinker with Parliament, in fact, not just tinker with it, to make it obsolete and to pass power to other organisations, such as the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court being, of course, an American import, which is completely incongruous with the British legal system. It used to be that the highest place in the land for law was the House of Lords, but now it is the Supreme Court. And not just the Supreme Court. Power was given away to all kinds of other quangos, such as the Office for Budget Responsibility and all kinds of other offices that are unelected and ultimately ensure power is taken away from Parliament and Parliament is less powerful and other groups which can be appointed by the government or appointed by civil servants are where the true power of the land lies.
The Tories have never really believed in democracy and quangos are the ultimate privatisation of power in our society. These are powers which we say should be exercised by elected authorities and not by unelected, faceless men. And they nearly always are men.
In 1994, the outspoken Labour shadow minister, Michael Meacher, bemoaned the anti-democratic nature of quangos in this speech at his party conference. However, far from ridding Britain of the quango, the new Labour visionaries realised they were an essential part of the project to consolidate power, for precisely the reasons Meacher outlined. More and more governance was taken out of the hands of the electorate and into an explosion of institutions run by appointment, not by election. New governments were set up in Wales and Scotland, with Blair assuming they would become permanent Labour fiefdoms. As Robert Conquest famously observed, any organisation that is not explicitly right-wing will in time become left-wing. And so piece by piece, the governance of the United Kingdom would submit to permanent left-wing rule. In the grand theatre of British politics, the rise of David Cameron appeared to many as a harbinger of change. Yet behind the glossy rhetoric of a big society and the promises of austerity, Cameron's tenure as Prime Minister was less a radical departure from his predecessors and more a seamless continuation of the Blairite project. Tony Blair had redefined the political landscape with a vision that married supposedly neoliberal economics with a veneer of progressive social policies. Cameron, ostensibly the torchbearer of a rejuvenated Conservative Party, found himself navigating the same currents. Devolution to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, the establishment of the Supreme Court and the incorporation of the European Convention on Human Rights into British law, none of this was reversed. Instead, the Conservative Party embraced it, understanding that the new political reality they created was not easily undone, attempting to redefine conservatism as paternalistic managerialism and hope the voters wouldn't notice. The Scottish independence referendum, far from quelling the devolutionary tide, further entrenched it, and Cameron's handling of Brexit revealed the deep entanglement of the UK with European institutions that would take years, if not decades, to properly undo. A legacy of Blair's enthusiastic Europeanism. The promise of a big society gave way to the practicalities of maintaining a complex web of institutional changes that Blair had set in motion. This is the world we now inhabit. An era defined not by abrupt change, but by the subtle, pervasive continuity of a radical reimagining of society. A central pillar of the project was immigration. For years, immigration had hovered around the tens of thousands. And in the 1960s and 70s, as Britons fled to the sunnier climes of the Commonwealth nations, net migration was in the negative.
Opportunity for you. Fine for your wife. Great for your children. You could be on your way to a sunnier future in the new year.
Then in the late 1990s, it exploded. And by the 2020s, the situation had become catastrophic.
Net migration to the UK has hit the highest figure ever recorded.
And it got up to over 700,000.
Towards double a reasonably sized British city.
There's a lot of research on this. Basically, a united society, a high trust society, is based around sameness. Because people that are genetically similar to each other.
Are you ready for the future of the West?